This program has been recorded for a print and visually impaired audience for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to More Tales from Tar Heel Ghosts. I'm your host, Laura Arwood. When I was young, my best friend, Bonnie Sykes, would scare me with stories of ghosts and ghouls who haunted my native North Carolina. Later, I discovered her stories had come from a book written by her uncle, John Harden, titled Tar Heel Ghosts, published in 1954. Tonight, my friends, Nicola Loeffler, Phil Lewis, and Kurt Benrood, bring you more tales from Tar Heel Ghosts.
I'm Kurt Benrood, and this story is called Buried Alive. Buried Alive, the very term brings a chill that grips the spine. Many people have had a secret dread that it might happen to them, and it actually has happened to a few. One of those rare instances is dealt with here, because a ghost is also involved. Wilmington in 1810 is the setting of this chiller-diller. A young man named Samuel R. Jocelyn lived in Wilmington at that time. He stood well in the community, was clean of habit, and had a fine character. His father was a well-known attorney who had also been reared in Wilmington, and, like his son, enjoyed a fine reputation. Young Jocelyn had a friend, Alexander Hostler. According to a record of this ghostly episode written more than a century ago, the two were inseparable. Their Damon and Pythias relationship knew no interruption or misunderstanding. There were no recognized breaches or interferences in it. Where one went, the other usually went too. They shared their thoughts, their ideals, their aspirations. At work and play, in study, in sports, in entertainment, they were almost always to be found side by side. These young friends became interested in metaphysics, beginning with the study of philosophy and then turning to the psychology of that day. They began delving deep into mental and spiritual realms. They shared their findings as well as their enthusiasm with their associates, who found them always ready to discuss this special interest. One summer day in 1810, in conversation with a group of friends, their talk turned to the possibility of a person's returning to Earth after death, in some form or other, and making his presence known. Most of the group ridiculed such a possibility. However, the two friends argued that it might happen and, while not especially championing the theory, stoutly defended its possibility, even though their companions made fun of them. They maintained that there must be some way for a departed spirit to return and actually indicate what was happening to him in the other world. The conversation ended with a positive agreement between Jocelyn and Hostler that the first of the two to die would certainly reveal himself to the one who survived. The others in the group laughed and took the whole thing lightly. But later developments recalled that particular occasion and that specific conversation most vividly to the minds of all who had been there. Jocelyn was a great lover of horses. He liked riding over the bridle paths of the beautiful forests around Wilmington. Hostler, however, less interested, sometimes failed to follow along on those occasions. It was the one common interest in which they differed in the extent of their participation. One afternoon, Jocelyn set out alone for a ride. A few hours later, he was found in the road, unconscious. He lay beneath an oak in a forest of centenarian trees clustered together in massive beauty. His horse was grazing a few yards away alongside a stretch of sandy road. Two men in a cart, passers-by, picked up Jocelyn and carried him home. Everything known to the medical science of that day was done to bring the young man back to consciousness. But all attempts were fruitless, and he was finally pronounced dead. 2 days later, he was buried in the St. James Church burial ground in the heart of the city of Wilmington, a cemetery that has been in use for more than 200 years. Appropriate services were held, with many friends and relatives present. Hostler was greatly affected by the sudden death of his close friend. He refused to be comforted. 2 nights after the funeral, according to the recorded story, Hostler was in the room that he and Jocelyn had often occupied together. His thoughts were entirely taken up with the associations of the familiar room and his acute grief for the friend he had lost. And sitting there, under the deep shadow of his loneliness, Hostler was suddenly overwhelmed completely by the appearance of Jocelyn himself, who said, "How could you let me be buried when I was not yet dead?" "Not dead?" the horrified Hostler exclaimed. "No, I was not. Open the coffin, and you will see that I am not lying in the position in which you placed me." And then the ghost-like figure of Jocelyn was gone. Hostler was astounded by the vividness of the appearance of his friend. Even though he had believed that the dead might somehow manage to reappear and convey impressions to the living, he could not convince himself that what had happened was a reality. He wondered if he had not been overcome by the intentness of his own thoughts. He finally came to the conclusion that it was all a trick of the imagination. Feeling sure that no one would believe what had happened, he decided to say nothing about it. But the following night, when he was again alone in the room, thinking about his friend, Jocelyn, the apparition appeared with the same inquiry. Only this time, the tone was more intent. "How could you let me be buried when I was not yet dead?" Hostler's wonder was even greater than on the night before. But he again convinced himself that he was the victim of his own imagination. He now decided that such a thing was not within the realm of possibility, and he concluded once more to say nothing about it, lest he be considered a fool. But the third successive night brought the same occurrence, and this time the query was even more positive, more pleading. "How could you let me be buried when I was not yet dead?" The voice of Jocelyn implored Hostler to make an investigation. Hostler was no longer able to convince himself that it was the working of a fevered imagination. He decided that he must take action. He was completely bewildered by the strange visits and the phantom words of his dead friend on 3 successive nights. Would those to whom he might turn for help give proper attention to his story, or would they think his mind was giving way under the grief that had so overcome him? But he carried out his resolution, and the next morning he told the most unbelievable circumstances to a friend, Lewis Toomer, the prominent Wilmingtonian of that day. In Toomer, Hostler found a friend who was sympathetic to the point of feeling that some investigation must be made. The two went to call on the parents of Jocelyn and recited to them the happenings of the past 3 nights. The grieving parents listened to the story of the strange visitations and offered no objection to the suggestion that the body be disinterred. They asked only that the exhumation be carried out as privately as possible, in order that no opportunity be afforded for curious persons to know what was being done. The wishes of the parents were, of course, respected by Hostler and Toomer, who were in thorough agreement. They therefore decided to disinter the body at night. So at midnight, following the third visitation of the apparition, Hostler and Toomer went to the St. James churchyard armed with shovels to move the loosely packed earth and implements to open the coffin. After a brief period of toil, the coffin appeared under the flicker of lanterns. When it was completely uncovered, the two men removed the casket lid. This done, they lowered a lantern closer. The body of Jocelyn was lying face down. There were further evidences of brief but frantic struggles in the close confines of the coffin, struggles that had actually loosened one side of the coffin. Hostler and Toomer faced the awful truth. Their friend had indeed been buried alive. Death, real and final death, in the form of suffocation, must have come quickly to the frantic young man. The assumption is that the fall from the horse brought on a state of catalepsy, with suspension of animation and accompanying muscular rigidity. This continued comatose state, with every appearance of death, convinced everyone that the youth was indeed dead.
This is Nicola Leffler reading The Three Veils. This true ghost story was told by the late Dr. H.M. Wagstaff, for years professor of history at the University of North Carolina. His friends heard him tell it many times, and once, presumably at the request of editor Lewis Graves, he wrote a short version of his experience for the Chapel Hill Weekly. The experience came to Dr. Wagstaff when he was starting out as a young professor. Since ghosts do seem to have gender, we can identify Dr. Wagstaff's at the outset as being of the female variety, and quite a romantic one, too. Reports on this young lady in her pre-phantom days are vague, but Dr. Wagstaff vouched for her beauty and grace in ethereal form. All that he ever saw of her was a lovely hand emerging from a lacy sleeve. All he ever heard from her was a sigh. Her stamping ground, or should it be her gliding ground, was a room in a deserted college dormitory where Dr. Wagstaff had temporary occupancy. Until his first meeting with the beautiful ghost, he was entirely ignorant of her and of her tragic story. One of the North Carolina church conferences had got hold of a run-down, abandoned little college up in the mountains and was getting ready to revive the institution. Recently minted from Chapel Hill, as he described himself, Dr. Wagstaff was one of the seven people engaged for the faculty, and before the opening of college, he was sent up there to get things straight. It was quite an eerie and forlorn place, this deserted campus. Dr. Wagstaff's sole companions were a large colony of hoot owls which lived in the bellless belfry and the trees outside the windows of his semi-bare downstairs room in one of the vacant dormitories. When he was away, he always kept this room and the whole building locked. One night he came home from skylarking with some girls in the village, and after unlocking the building and his room and then relocking them, he did not light the lamp because the light from a full moon shining through two big windows flooded the room. It was in this pale moonlight, as he got ready for bed, that he heard a thin whispered sigh. He lit the lamp then fast enough. "As I turned from the lamp," he wrote in his Chapel Hill Weekly account, "there floated down past my shoulder a long filmy veil such as women used to wear in their hats. It dropped to the floor and lay still. I was in no hurry to pick it up, though I finally did, with something of dread. It was real enough, perfectly black in color, and of very fine texture. Musing on this strange occurrence, I laid the veil away and finally slept. One night, a week later, when he was back in his room under similar circumstances, a second veil floated to the floor at his feet. This one was heliotrope in color, he said, longer and of finer quality than the black one. He put it away with the first. Then he lay down and tried to get to sleep, leaving the lamp burning low. But more followed. Barely had I begun to relax when a beautiful hand, a woman's hand, the arm emerging from a lacy sleeve, came up over the edge of my bed. It hesitated a moment, then took the edge of the sheet and drew it up to my chin. I heard the faint echo of a sigh, then the hand was gone. But a third veil lay on my chest. This veil was dark slate in color and was not in as good condition as the other two. Not long after that experience, a young man of the village accompanied Dr. Wagstaff to his room in the college. "You are living in the haunted room of this place," the young man told him. Dr. Wagstaff's questions brought out the fact that before the college went on the rocks, the room had been occupied by one of the men teachers, who one night had been visited by a beautiful young lady whom he had pulled up through the window. Several months later, she killed herself, so the rumor said. "She was found in this room with veils knotted around her throat," Dr. Wagstaff's acquaintance told him. "It sounded more like murder, unless she used the veils to hang herself." Nell Battle Lewis, Raleigh News and Observer columnist, long interested in psychic experiences and phenomena of this sort, also published Dr. Wagstaff's ghost story. With it, she published a letter from Dr. Wagstaff answering her question, "What became of the three veils?" In his letter, Dr. Wagstaff said, "I kept them with me and presented them to an elderly sister of mine, at the same time giving her the gist of the story of their origin. She laughed, accepted the veils, and said she would make better use of them."
This is Phil Lewis reading The House of the Opening Door. We never saw any ghosts, but something came out or went in through that door every blessed night, no matter how tight it had been nailed shut. Thus, a one-time occupant of the House of the Opening Door on Salula Mountain near Hendersonville set the stage for this story. It's a story that old-timers and present-timers like to tell and retell, and one that has excited local and regional curiosity for many years. Against Hendersonville's beautiful scenery and amid its resort atmosphere stands the gaunt skeleton of the House of the Opening Door. It was once the typical home of a happy North Carolina mountain family. It is a vague reminder of better years and less spooky times. Like all country homes that are unoccupied, this one became overgrown with straggling vines and crowding shrubbery. It took on a tattered appearance from continued neglect of pauper care. For years it sheltered only an occasional unfortunate who crept into the place to put a roof between him and a storm and to get some protection as the weather-beaten structure offered. The place is more generally known locally as the John Drew House. A busy highway carries a constant flow of traffic close by the place. Once open fields are today chopped into crooked checkerboards of small home places. The Drew House is about a mile from the center of the town of Hendersonville and not a great distance from the railroad, near a point where trains round a sharp curve before the final stretch down to the Hendersonville station. Few have been brave enough to approach the place in the dead of night because of its haunted reputation. When the house was first built, there was a long L running back from the main two-story structure. This housed the kitchen, pantry, and servants' quarters. The dining room was in the main portion of the building and was connected with the L by a doorway. In later years, this dining room was made into a living room. In the room is a fireplace, and the walls were once lined with books. It takes but little time and a little imagination to see the man of the house comfortably established in a cozy room surrounded by his books, enjoying the embers of a fire on the hearth. Such was the picture many years ago. John Drew sat thus one night, enjoying his fire, his books, his home. The midnight freight train coming into Hendersonville sounded a long blast as it rounded the curve and thundered down the straight grade to the station. The re-echoing blast split the midnight stillness and roused John Drew from his book. And then, as the thundering train moved on, the big door leading into the L of the home swung open, slowly, majestically, and with certainty. And John Drew sat looking through the open doorway into the dismal blackness of the room beyond. Naturally, he was both surprised and puzzled. But his amazement grew the following night when the door again swung open, again exactly on the minute, at midnight. And when the thing became a regular, methodical, nightly occurrence, his amazement changed to chilling horror. From then on, as long as John Drew was there to see it, the heavy door swung open wide on the stroke of each midnight.
Harriet, his wife, begged John to have the door closed for good, locked or nailed shut. She even suggested that they seal the opening and cut a new door. The performance was beginning to get on her nerves, too. But John Drew, a man strong in his own convictions, told Harriet that whatever it was that was opening that door every night and coming through it, as he believed, would not be barred with wood, nails, or plaster. "When the time comes, it will be here, door or no door," he told her. Of course, the story got about the neighborhood, as such stories have a way of doing, and people probably smiled as they usually do and credited all the fuss and mystery to the overactive imaginations of John Drew and his wife Harriet. So the strange tale, when first told about the Hendersonville countryside, was given little credence. And then certain other uncanny things began to happen around the big old house. An unspoken dread of the place grew and developed. A strange silence surrounded it, save, of course, on those nights when the mountain wind blew down the hills, following the valley and the railroad tracks. Winds sometimes attained tremendous velocity at that point and hit the old Drew house and the grove of trees surrounding it with such a roar and scream that the devil himself might be driving the blow. At any rate, the time came when John Drew saw the door open methodically and silently for the last time. What he may or may not have learned that last time is a mystery. With the healing passage of years, another family named Jones finally moved into the rambling old house. The Jones family did not know that the house had been looked at askance. They knew only that it was a rather lonely place where great piles of leaves had drifted against the side of the house and where vines hung dead in the wind. So the Jones family arrived and plunged into much raking and sweeping and trimming of the yard, the grounds, and the grove. Where silence once reigned in the old house on Solola Mountain, children again romped. But it was not many nights before the new occupant was sitting before the great yawning fireplace at the midnight hour, with no previous knowledge of the story of the opening door. He reported his amazement as midnight arrived, and he was about to put out the light to see the door suddenly swing wide open. No one appeared to be there. No one seemed to have touched the door. It just swung ajar. But this new tenant added another touch. He said that as the door stood wide open, he thought he heard a weird chuckle from the vacant room beyond. When he reported a repetition of this occurrence, the stories of the Drew family's experience came back to light, and the neighborhood buzzed anew with tales of the house of the opening door. And then the story reached the ear of an engineer recently arrived in Hendersonville to serve certain mining interests. This engineer became interested, and he asked the occupants to allow him to look the house over carefully. He also interested some fellow engineers in the project, and they set out to solve the mystery of the house of the opening door. With permission, these men came for several succeeding nights and looked and listened and watched and waited and saw the midnight phenomenon of the opening door. Scientific men that they were, cold-blooded engineers, it was nevertheless revealed that one of them approached the mystery with a pistol in his pocket. And more than one of them confessed that, as the midnight hour arrived during the period of observation, they felt a bit odd. On the first night, as the engineer sat and waited, the usual midnight sounds came and went, climaxed by the long wailing whistle which signaled the arrival of the midnight train. Then the door swung slowly open, moved along its arch, and stopped against the wall. Of course, the engineers knew that there was a natural cause for what they called the problem of the house of the opening door. They referred to it thus instead of the mystery of the house of the opening door, as did the townspeople. So these men of science read and studied. They measured dimensions, and they examined relative angles as they sat around the fire and discussed the matter and waited each night for the door to swing open at midnight. They filled out sheets with figures, drew lines, and plotted graphs. And then they announced that they had come to a decision. They submitted this decision in a formal written report that began thus. The mountains of western North Carolina are the oldest in the world. At one time they stretched across what is now the Pacific Ocean to join this country with Japan. In these old, old mountains are many peculiar geologic formations, strange stratas of rock which are found in few other mountain ranges. We would call attention to the fact that on many of the mountain tops there are found bold, flowing springs. The structure, locally known as the House of the Opening Door, rests on a hill of almost solid rock where the soil in some places is just a few feet thick, and in others only scant inches. The midnight train, which it passes through every night at almost the same time, is the heaviest freight going over this route. It has a clear track, for there are no other trains passing near this time, and its rate of speed is unchecked. The terrific weight and velocity of this train jars a certain strata of rock as it makes the curve just before reaching the straight sweep into the water tank at the station. As an unusual, perhaps remarkable, coincidence, the House of the Opening Door rests on the same vein and strata of rock, and the vibrations are carried from one point to the other. The opening door has been measured very carefully, and we find that it does not hang exactly true. So the trembling shock imparted to the layer of rock by the heavy train is carried in successive waves to the stout foundation under that part of the house. The trembling is sufficient to swing the door open. Our deductions are quite correct, for we have verified them over and over again. The occupants of the house were encouraged by the findings and the reports of the engineers. The case was so unusual and had led to so much surmise and conjecture that the report of the study by the engineers, with their deductions, was published in detail. The investigation brought conclusions satisfactory to all. That report really should have settled all questions about the things that happened in that old house on Salola Mountain above Henderson County Valley. The occupants of the House of the Opening Door breathed easier, lived happily. For a time it was thought that the matter was closed. And then one night Mr. Jones and his son Jack sat in the room of the opening door when the midnight hour approached. For some reason, the blast of the train whistle was missing. There was some interruption in the rail schedule, and in spite of this, when midnight struck, the door swung open very, very slowly. Father and son sat in newfound horror, gazing into the black depths of the room beyond. There was no sound. There had been no train. And yet the door opened and swung back to rest against the wall just as it had been doing for years. The House of the Opening Door was a mystery again. It was too much for the occupants of the house, and on that very day they moved on, never to put foot in the house again. And so the House of the Opening Door stood, more than ever ravaged by time and weather and neglect. The place had the respect of those who did not like to risk association with spirits. A few brave souls came, looked about, and peeked in through windows at the dust-shrouded interior where spiderwebs sealed in the empty bookshelves. Again silence fell over Salola Mountain, save for the noises of the elements. The house grew grayer and grayer and more forlorn-looking. And thus we leave it. Maybe the engineers, wise in the ways of science, had the answer. Maybe that opening of the door when there was no train was a happen-so. But as men love mysteries and shy at spirits, the House of the Opening Door became an unsolved mystery to the people of Henderson County and an interesting ghost legend of that interesting section of North Carolina.
Thank you for listening to More Tales from Tar Heel Ghost. Now please, have a relaxing evening, if you can.
This program has been recorded for a print and visually impaired audience. Please direct questions or comments to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. You can also visit the website at www.triangleReadingService.org, where TRRS provides podcasts of 30 magazines and other information and entertainment programs, like More Tales from Tar Heel Ghosts.